You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello and welcome to episode 197 of the Christian Feminist Podcast. I'm Victoria Reynolds Farmer, and with me today are Katie Grubbs and Sarah Kluster. Hey, Katie and Sarah.
Hi. Evening.
Let's introduce ourselves for anybody that might be new to the show. Sarah, how about you go first?
Hello, everyone. My name is Sarah Kluster. I am a married mother of two. I have two children under the age of three, or two children three and under at the moment, and we attend a Presbyterian church here in Tyler, Texas.
Thanks, Sarah. Katie?
I'm Katie Grubbs. I live in Leeds, Alabama, with my husband, David Grubbs, of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And our four children. I am a teacher. At this point in my life, that takes the form of online adjuncting for my university, Houston Christian University. And I also am now working sometimes as a substitute teacher in our local schools. So I'm getting to see the lower school side of education for the first time from the teacher's perspective, not as a parent. Like I said, we have four kids. They are 12, 9, 8, and 6. We now have a middle schooler, an elementary schooler, and one in kindergarten. So we're kind of all over the place. And three of our kids are autistic. And we've also been kind of negotiating some interesting vision issues with our one that's not autistic. And it's looking like he's going to have some accommodations at school too. So we have a lot of kind of stuff that we've been working on with our kids. And all that's been really interesting. And also with how it intersects with their spiritual development, which is what we're talking about tonight. So that's perfect.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get both of your perspectives on this issue. Hi, everyone. I am Victoria Reynolds Farmer. I'm one of the founding members of the CFP and our lone childless panelist for this episode, though I do have lots of nieces and nephews and a goddaughter who I'm sure I'll be talking about a lot tonight. I have a PhD in literature and gender studies from Florida State. By day, I work as an engagement manager at a market research firm, and really excited to have a discussion tonight about children's religious education and how to frame that, tips we've used to relate to the children in our lives, and I'm excited to hear from the two of you about what you do in your families as well. So the reason I wanted to record this episode is, as I just mentioned, though I do not have children, I am really getting into a place in my life where I'm trying to be more intentional about how I pour into the children in my life. My goddaughter is about 2.5. I have nieces and a nephew that range from ages 8 to 18, almost 19. So I have really been thinking a lot about what kind of example I am to them, how I love them, how I care for them, and how I can kind of be a part of these children's lives that make up my community. And because I know this podcast is such a great resource for parents who care about those same issues, I wanted to have this conversation. When I first started thinking about it, the first piece that I found was a PBS NewsHour piece. It was the first result when I Googled children's religious education. I just wanted to see what came up. And this piece is called 10 Commandments for Talking to Your Kids About Religion. And interestingly, the position that it assumes is that you and your children are not religious and that you're kind of not exactly defending them against religion, but it does kind of assume a defensive position, assume that religion is the social default and that you wouldn't especially want it to be in your particular family. So because that was the opposite of the kind of article I was looking for, I really wanted to talk about that on this show and kind of think about what my friends and people that I have respected have done in their own families and how they talk about these issues that, while they might not affect me directly, I really feel like I could learn a lot from. So the first question I would like to ask is, tell us a little bit about the routines you have in your own families in terms of how you start talking to your children about how your family practices religion, and maybe a little bit about how this evolves as your kids get older.
It's kind of changed a little bit over time. I like that you mentioned the development with age, because when our kids were smaller, we did more, I don't know what the word is. We did more prescriptive stuff in the sense of like teaching them things to sing or to say. Like when they were very small, at least with the older three, when they were very small, we would sing the doxology and the Gloria Patri every night when we put them to bed. And so they learned it when they were tiny. And we haven't been doing that with our fourth, but with our fourth, we say a prayer with her before bed every night. And so they were kind of, you know, absorbing that when they were small. David and I were an interesting collision of approaches the way that our parents raised us, because we both grew up in like Southern Baptist families, and our parents had us at church every week. Like that was a commonality. But David's parents were very much on the, everything we do in our life is going to be driven by the spiritual formation of our children to the nth degree. So like they were homeschooled with Christian curriculum from like Bob Jones, and they, you know, and like, this is wild to me because I don't like to get up early, but when David was a kid, despite them being homeschooled, they all had to get up every morning at 6 a.m. so they could all sit at the breakfast table with their dad and listen while he read scripture. And they like read as a family at like 6 a.m. and they would read like 5 Psalms and a proverb every day. And I'm like, because I like sleeping.
That's a lot in addition to being early.
I know. Like, and now I will say he knows the Psalms like the back of his hand as a grown up, and I'm a little envious of that sometimes.
I love it, like, in terms of like scripture memorization. Obviously a lot of like really great commitment, but I can't imagine doing that as a kid, or B, like being someone leading that family. Like that's a lot of dedication.
They were like very, very hardcore. And like, meanwhile, over at our house, my parents always had us at church. My parents both served in church. We definitely had we definitely were able to see my mom's, you know, like that she read the Bible every day, that she was, you know, that she kept a prayer journal. Like I can picture it in my mind right now, because I think she still has the same one that we know. And so we knew, like we kind of saw that going down, but we didn't do the like family worship stuff at home. We went to public school, like, you know, so it was, faith was a part of our life at my mom and dad's, but it was less of that kind of prescriptive routine. Everything we do is going to be arranged around that, and more we're super involved at church. We talk about spiritual. I mean, my mom prayed with me to receive Christ when I was a little kid and I first became a Christian. That was with her, not with like my Sunday school teachers. So it was definitely something that was happening in our house, but it was a less regimented. That sounds negative. I don't mean that, but it was less, literally less of a program, like, and less of an organized.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there, Katie.
Yes, it was, but, more like, ad hoc.
They hadn't bought a book from Amazon that was like how to personally lead your child to Christ, and they weren't like following it through like step by step. Like they were doing one of those kind of things.
Well, I think that was kind of a piece too. I mean, you know, I think a lot of the homeschool families they knew had similar spiritual disciplines, and you know, it was just a slightly different approach. Now with David and I, though, the way that it's kind of happened out, the way that we do with our kids is a lot closer to how my parents did than his. Not because he hated that and wanted to get away from it, but in part because all of our kids now have some kind of special need. Homeschooling was just never going to work for us. And so we're more kind of in the secular life of like being at public school. But, you know, we have our kids at church all the time. They see both of us serving at church, not just showing up for the service. They see us teaching. They know that we're teaching the Bible at church. And the main thing I think that we do now that they're bigger, and I really do wish we had been better about Bible memorization, because we've never been great about that. We've never been great about remembering to pray before we eat, to the point that when we're at my mom and dad's and there's always a prayer if we have a family dinner, and my kids will be like, "Mom, how come we don't pray before we eat at home?" And I'm always like, shamed. Like, you're right, we should. But what we do really well and frequently is that we talk about spiritual things all the time, anytime it comes up. Like, we never miss an opportunity in the moment in a conversation to not even to steer the conversation that way, but just to answer their questions, their spiritual questions, right then in the moment. We don't, we try not to water stuff down. I just had a conversation this week with Cabin, because he's asking me things like, why don't my eyes work the way that other people's do? Like, why do I have to do vision therapy? What's that about? Like, and I can tell he's struggling with like, why do hard things have to happen to us? You know, school is hard for him because it's hard for him to read. And the other day he asked me, why do we have to go to school? Why can't we just be born knowing everything we already need to know? Right. Cause it's a struggle for him. And so I've already been having to have conversations with him about like, okay, well, things are hard. Hard things happen because the world has fallen. And like, what does that mean? And we talk about what that means. And, you know, and another reason that God allows hard things in our lives is because every time a hard thing happens, we have a chance to be like Jesus, right? Like, so, you know, we've had to have some of these conversations. So I think we do a better job at the kind of talk about it. By the way, what's that verse where they in the Bible, I think it's in Exodus, when it says you need to like bind the scriptures onto your body, but also talk about them with your kids when you're like walking along the way. We're really good at the walking along the way talks and less good at the more formalized spiritual disciplines in our house. That's how I'll say it.
I like that distinction. And I also really like that you discussed kind of the notion of you grew up in this kind of family and he grew up in this kind of family, and you've taken from both of those things in these ways. Because I think everybody, every marriage and every family, people who don't have kids have to do this too, but I'm sure that people who do have kids have to do this, you know, in an even more serious way, have to figure out kind of where your family fits in all of these traditions and things that you grew up doing. So thanks for sharing that, Katie.
Sure.
Sarah, how about you? Your kids are younger than Katie's, and I imagine you might have a slightly different experience.
We do. So my husband and I are in a more liturgical traditional, we're Anglican, or he's Anglican, and I have as a Baptist have been like, you know, this is actually pretty good. I don't really mind being going to an Anglican church, but I don't want to say I'm Anglican, but I'm pretty much Anglican these days. But we're currently, there's not an ACNA affiliated church, here in Tyler. So we've been going to a Presbyterian church. And one of the things that our kids are finally old enough here that they can really come into the service with us. And so what most liturgical churches will do, and that has been beneficial for them is we put them in nursery when we get there. And then basically we go through the whole service, And we go get them basically when it's time for communion, because since they're already baptized, we can take communion all together as a family. We don't have the kids partake yet, just because, again, they're not really old enough to understand what we're doing. But I think part of the important part of that is you can see them getting better at it every week, because every week they get used to it. Every week they get used to the song. And I think that that's really important, because I think so much of religious education, especially from a more liturgical tradition, comes from just absolute familiarity with it. And when I was a kid, I grew up Southern Baptist. And so I didn't go to big church, as I called it, and I still call it big church sometimes. I didn't go to big church until I was like 5 or 6, because I was hanging on to dear life to not have to go to the service, because it just seemed so incredibly boring to me as a child. And so my parents had to make like a special extra like thing that I could stay in nursery longer than I was supposed to, because I just was like not having it. And then even once I started to go to service, I would just lay down on the pew and nap on the pew when I was a kid. And so I think for our kids, and so my parents are, I think, really had our spiritual formation was the thing that happened at church, because we were there all the time. We were there Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Wednesday night. Like Katie, I grew up seeing my parents serve. My parents served on committees. They taught classes. My mother has her whole life been very faithful in a daily quiet time. She has books and books of Beth Moore, Henry Blackaby, that she has Bible studies that she's gone through. And so to me, I think seeing the dailiness of worship through my mother has always been incredibly impactful for me. And then I think it's kind of funny how so many times as a non-liturgical tradition, we find things from something that, you know, is more liturgical, and we're like, hey, that seems really great. What if we had a daily prescriptive prayer that we read every day, guys? Wouldn't that be great? And all of the liturgical traditions are like, yeah, yeah, that seems like it might be kind of a good thing. Who could have ever thought about that, right?
That is like reason A number one with a bullet. Not really, this is not true. Actual reason A number one with a bullet, I am Catholic, is that the Blessed Virgin prayed for me to be Catholic, and I know this to be true. But another reason that I am Catholic is I find so much freedom and depth of tradition, and like I'm so set free by those prescriptive prayers. I pray the hours a lot, particularly the evening prayer. But this idea that like you're praying these words that millions of people for thousands of years have prayed and you're connected to them is great. But also, the thing I hated most growing up Southern Baptist was the extemporaneous public prayer. Like,
dear God, I just ask that you, and I just ask that you, yeah. I just ask that you.
Yeah, makes me want to die. Like, I'm breaking out in hives just hearing you do that. Like, I can't.
I completely agree. And so I had probably been, I was very prepped to probably marry someone who was a more liturgical, and so my husband's Anglican, and that's essentially the only places that we've attended a Baptist church here or there for me. But the only times where we've been really happy and really felt very fed have been when we're in a more liturgical tradition. And my grandmother, I will tell you, my whole life, whenever I stay the night with my paternal grandmother, she had not a daily office, but I don't even remember that. It was basically a daily devotions book that, you know, once upon a time it was called the Sunday School Board, and now Lifeway pushes out, you know, a daily reading with little sermons and every year, and one for every single day. And so she buys it every year, and we read it through, and we pray it every single morning while we're sitting at breakfast. And so I feel like I've been primed my whole life to be part of a much more liturgical tradition. And our children are really experiencing that through
being with us when we participate in communion. And so one of the things we are working towards with my older daughter is just we pray every night. And it's not a long prayer because she got a short attention span. But we pray for the people who we love and that God is with them, and that that those who are dear to us are taken care of. And we're moving slowly towards it. My both of the kids, it's really going to kickstart for them this year because they're starting Mother's Day out, and so they're doing it at a church. And so I know that we will really kickstart a lot of stuff that. In terms of Bible stories, they'll probably really increase. I am a bit of a snob on some of the children's lit stuff, and most of the really good children's books are not Christian affiliated, or at least a lot of the ones that I found. And so I think we're going to kickstart a lot of that once they start going to Mother's Day out. And I think that we will see a much bigger push on some of that, because that will be somebody else other than just us enforcing it or reinforcing it, I guess you should say. Our plan is, our kids will grow up, they will go through confirmation, they will go to, I'm trying to remember the name because it's the end of the long week, but they will basically, they're going to learn the Westminster Confession, all that stuff. They'll be able to do their confirmation when they're older. And I think we plan on doing obviously a lot of their formation ourselves, but when we were looking for churches, I was telling the churches I was talking to, I want a church that cares about my child's formation and that they're not just going to let them play. And, I'm very lucky because I feel like we found a church currently that really cares about that.
That is super, super important. And I just realized that I didn't actually say one word about our church. And I probably should have, because they're really great at supporting parents. But the other piece of our kids' spiritual formation that is happening too is that at our church, the way that they do special needs ministry is amazing. And that's one of the main reasons we're at our church, because there is special needs ministry. It's like a thing that is there, which is often not true in churches. But the way that they do it is that instead of our kids being in a different place or sequestered or something, both of my kids, only two of our four kids need this, but my two kids who need it, they have a buddy who's a grown-up who goes with them into the class with them with all the other kids and basically helps our kids to be a part of the class, like helps them to understand what's going on, helps them to, if they can't handle it, especially my son can't handle noise. And so if the small room full of lots of kids gets too much for him, Miss Gwen takes him out and they go to the sensory room and he can chill or he can wear his headphones or whatever. Miss Gwen is a sweet lady in her 60s and she's amazing. And she's been with him since we came to this church 3 years ago. And she's every Sunday she's there with him unless she's on vacation or something.
I love that so much.
It's so good.
I really feel like, and I'm glad that we're kind of hitting on this organically, but I feel like it's almost more important the kind of community support you're talking about, like church members actually being alongside kids in, especially, I mean, as a person with a disability, hearing you talk about how inclusion is baked into your church really just warms my heart. I love that so much. This is what the church should be, right? It should meet all of its members where they are, especially children, and think about them as whole, complete people. I love that.
Well, and it's so good too, because they're really taking it like a whole life approach too. Cause I know like our little kids have buddies, but there's also people who are buddies to teens and youth group. There's also I know that there's a small group, an adult small group of people with special needs. And they can pick any small group they want. They don't have to be in that small group, but if they want to, they can. And so it's kind of something that has been, and I know my mom was so taken and so kind of, she loved so much what was happening at our church that now at her church where they go in Georgia, now my mom is like a buddy. Like she helps with special needs ministry in her church because it just really touched her heart what was happening at our church.
Beautiful.
It was really sweet. I do think what you guys are saying, I do about the liturgy, I think is important. And that is my one kind of that's my one kind of thing that I do sometimes, not worry about, but I do think it would be nice, particularly because our kids are on the spectrum, if there was more stuff that was liturgical, because like you were talking about extemporaneous prayers, Victoria. So none of our kids yet have made a profession of faith. We've always felt like it's super important not to push them into anything. I was a really easily guilted kid. I was the kid that even after I was a Christian would struggle to sit through the altar call without feeling guilty.
Same.
And like I should probably go for it again.
Rededicate your life.
We're all like that.
My so mom, many times.
We're all baptized twice. Like, because we thought maybe it didn't take the first time. I don't know. But so when Arden was about 7 or 8, we felt like she was really, really close to saying that she wanted to kind of make a profession of faith the way that the Baptists do, but she didn't say that, and we were not going to push her into that because she's very much one of the ways her autism works in her is that she has a really hard time making any 100% yes or no definitive statements. She really struggles with, like, if anybody asked her, do you know beyond a shadow of a doubt, she would be done. Like, because she'd be like, well, I mean, no. Because she's intelligent and she realizes that, like, I can't. And with her, it's she feels like she doesn't mean it if she doesn't feel it 100% in every cell of her body at that moment, which is why she pretty rarely tells us, her parents, that she loves us, even though we know that she does. Because if she feels like if she's not feeling loving, she must not actually, it must not be true. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say? Which has made it really hard for her to stick to something as abstract as faith. All that to say, none of our kids have made a profession of faith, but I'm not sure how it's going to go when they do, because the way it happens at our church is you go up to get baptized in front of the whole church and you read out loud a testimony about how you came to faith that you have written in your own words. And you have to like talk about, you know, like what your favorite verse is and how you feel about it. And I was like, David, what's going to happen? Like, but David said, and I'm going to ask, cause I'm going to go talk to Zach and them, the member care pastor and the guys in that office. I would like to know, what if somebody comes to them and says, for my baptism, may I recite the creed? Like, to share what I believe, like, cause I think that Arden would be very down for that. But I think
nice
the idea
of all the way.
Yeah, like, can somebody roll up and give the Apostles' Creed? Like, does it have to be so squishy and personal feelings? And, I mean, I know, I get that we're Baptists, but still, you know, I wish sometimes that we had those more, those prayers that were set, you know?
Well, and I hope for their sake that they just don't have a random non-believer come in that God moves and is like, can you baptize me? And they're like, well, I don't know. What's your favorite verse, man?
Well, I do appreciate they do have a very specific process they go through, and they want it because they want to make absolutely sure. Like, you don't see a lot of, it's interesting to me, you don't see a lot of young kids baptized at our church. And I don't think it's because they're not coming to faith. I think it's because they really push that you know exactly what you're doing when you go up there. And I do appreciate that. Like, you're never going to get a kid who just followed their friend up there and says yes when they ask, do you believe in Jesus? And then they dunk them. Like, there's a very kind of mindful, like, we're going to really talk to this person, whether it's a kid or a grown up, about why are you making this decision? Do you really believe this? Like that. And I do appreciate that, but I don't love that
there's a catechism that they kind of want them to go through is what I'm hearing.
I mean, yeah, not in so many words. Well, and I know they have said, like, and because we're congregational, right? So you were talking about your kids taking communion with you guys. Like, our kids aren't automatically considered members. And I didn't realize this till just the other day when we were talking about it at our Bible City leaders training. Kids of members who come to faith are still not, the kids are still not considered members till that kid is baptized. Then that kid is considered a church member. So there's like people with like teens in our church, the parents are members and the kid is a believer, but the kid has just never bothered to get around to being baptized. So that kid's still not considered a church member. Like, so it's
that's
just interesting.
That's very Baptist.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all from a Baptist perspective.
So it's interesting how it all plays out. But I do think sometimes that it might be easier for, and I mean, David and I went to a PCA church for a while in Athens and we enjoyed our PCA church. But when we moved out to Kansas, we didn't have PCA in our town anyway, but also as we get to the point where we started having kids and we realized that our personal beliefs about infant baptism didn't align with the PCA would have been fine with us being there with them, but we wanted to be in a church where we could affirm every single thing our church was doing, if that makes sense. And so, you know, we went back to we were in a Bible church in Kansas, and then now we're in a Baptist church. So we've kind of been in different places, and I missed the liturgy. I loved our 3 or 4 years in the PCA for the liturgy. That was my favorite part. And I do miss it a lot.
If it makes you feel better, Katie, I was very squishy on infant baptism as well. And it was the thing that before Annie and I, it was the one thing that we were very different on. And basically before we got married, before we got engaged, we were like, we have to come to an agreement for something we can both live with on this.
Yeah, that's smart.
We have kids. And so and at the time I was very much attending a Baptist, I was still attending the Baptist church. We weren't married. But we basically came to the idea of like, he looked at me, he's like, do you think I'm not a Christian? And I was like, no. He's like, do you think my father is not a Christian? No. Do you think all of the millions? I was like, no, I don't. And he's like, okay. So what we came up with was we would go forward with our baptism as children. And then when they got older, we would just say, hey, this is what mommy did. And if you would like to do it again, if you would feel called to do it again, that is a choice you can choose to make.
Mm. Yeah, that's cool.
Which what would be more Baptist than being like, the first one didn't take? We gotta do it again.
Yeah. Well, and for us, it was never a dividing line as far as, like you said, like who's a Christian and who's not a Christian. Right. I had feelings about it because I wondered about, you know, I think I would have been confused as a kid to be told, well, you're baptized, but you still have to make a personal decision on your own. And how do those two things like play against each other? It was more just, I was worried more about it for psychological reasons that are probably all based in my like emotional baggage from when I was a kid. It was not it wasn't a problem. And I think if one of our kids grew up and was like, I think I'm gonna be Presbyterian, would be like, cool. Like, that'd be great.
It depends on what you think baptism does, right? Like, cause I, as a Catholic,
yes.
Now I think baptism is different than I was brought up to think baptism was when I was a kid. I mean, when I was a kid, baptism is a public expression of an inward belief. But now every Sunday I stand in front of a priest and say, I believe in one baptism for the forgiveness of sin, right? Which is a different thing. And and if we had kids, I would obviously get them baptized as soon as they would let us put their adorable little head under the hand of the priest. Because, you know, theologically it's different.
Well, and that's consistent. That was one of the things too. I was like baffled. It was always weird to me when we were in our PCA church that they would have been fine with David leading a community group when he wasn't down for it. And that bothered me. I'm like, wait, but like, if you guys are doing it, like, shouldn't you be more committed to it than that? Like, you know, like I was just, they were like, so kind of lazy. Some, maybe that was just our PCA church too, though. They were like so kind of whatever, chill and laissez-faire about it that I was thinking like, why are you doing this at all? Like, you know, because it didn't make sense to me.
I'm convinced, Katie, that so many PCA churches have had to absorb basically refugee Baptists that we would not, like, half of these churches is like, man, a lot of people like that. They didn't just kind of absorb and say, oh yes, anybody from, as long as we profess that Jesus is Lord, yes, you can take communion with us, all this kind of stuff, that they would probably, I think that a lot of it is they've absorbed a lot of Baptists that have come over. I mean, that's
tech. I've never
done any official conversion into Anglicanism or anything like that, but any Anglican church I've ever been to is like, yes, if you say that you're a believer in this, you can have communion. And the Baptist churches I attend are not that open. They would say, unless you have experienced believer's baptism, you cannot take the Lord's Supper, right? Like, they're actually much more restrictive for not being liturgical, which we think of as actually the more restrictive option. But
I will say that our church, I'm pretty sure they don't fence the table to that degree. I feel like at our church, you definitely don't have to have been baptized in our church to take communion. And I don't think that they don't split hairs about how you were baptized. If you're like just a visitor, about taking communion, like, it's, So the communion, there's fewer barriers around taking communion at church than there are around like being a church member who like votes. You know what I mean? So that's kind of part of it. I've been thinking about this a lot this week because our member care guys came and talked to us at our Bible study leaders training, and one of the things they talked to everybody about was, hey, what are our procedures around baptism? Like, they wanted to make sure we all knew that, you know, so that if we had any, because I've had ladies come to my Bible study group this year who don't go to our church, but they're coming to the midweek Bible study, you know, because their church doesn't have that or something. You know what I mean? That was really, I had a lady in my group last year who was charismatic, and she was like, yeah, you know, I didn't really like any Bible studies we were doing at my church, and so I just Googled Bible studies near me, and that's how I've wound up here. And so we had some really interesting discussions about prayer languages and all kinds of things that I had to learn about because I'm like, I don't what? So yeah, it's interesting going to a rather large church that doesn't have Baptist in the name, right? Even though we totally are. Like, we're the church at Brook Hills. Baptist isn't anywhere in it. So sometimes you get people there who I think are from other traditions and don't realize till they get in, really start to get in the process and do the membership class, like what everything they're signing up for as like a Baptist. It's just funny.
Yeah,
any church that's
Before we move much further, we're having a lot of really great conversation, but I want to tie us back to the readings for this episode
Yes, me own.
real quick. So the first reading we do not have to go deep into. I found it is a parents' guide from one specific church in Iowa, the Waterloo Catholic Church. And I wanted to link to it because it's just something on their church website that offers an outline for the way they scaffold faith formation as children grow up. And there are bullet points that link you to corresponding ministries this particular church offers. They divide it into sections by ages. There's an infant and young children section, birth to age 2, a preschool section, ages 3 to 5, a grade school section, ages 6 to 12, and an adolescent section, ages 13 to 17. It lays out expectations of what parents and children should be able to do at each of these sections of life. And it also, as I said, delineates the ministries of this particular church that serve parents and children of these ages. And I found it really interesting and practical, and wanted to talk to you about the kind of church and community support that your family has found helpful as your children get older. Katie, you already talked quite a bit about how your church supports your family. Sarah, you mentioned a little bit about the liturgy and how you're trying to integrate that into your children's life. Do either of you have other things to say here about church support and your children's religious education?
I saw when I looked at that list, it was very practical. I loved that list, and one of the things I thought was I loved most is that for young children, for very young children, infants, and like 0 to 2, it basically was just kind of said, live your life and just show your children what and let them observe you doing it, right? That there was for the very young children. Be a kind, loving parent for them. Have the symbols in your home. Let them watch you pray. And like, I love that because I think so much. I think we put a lot on ourselves. Like, this is up to me. I have to do it. And I think acknowledging that, like, yeah, just let them observe you being an observant Christian in real life. Like, that does a huge portion of the work for you, right? That was nice to see that as an acknowledgement. And especially for us, we are what I want to do on is start doing Compline with my daughter. But it's such a vain reason why I haven't done it yet, and I need to get over it, which is I have my Book of Common Prayer, but it's a lot. But to flip back, but I have to do a lot of flipping back and forth to get to the Psalms and all sorts of stuff. And I have an 18a Book of Common Prayer app on my phone, which is a lot easier to use. but I don't really want to use my phone with it because it feels like that somehow makes, like, I'm the kind of person who's like, no, you should read your actual Bible and not, like, look at your Bible app on your phone.
I do the hours on my iBreviary app, so it's totally, it still counts. but I understand what you mean.
Then I'm like, does this feel less holy and important because we're reading it off of my phone as opposed to the nice leather-bound book with the gilded pages and all of the little things in it? But I thought it was a great, and I thought it was a very easy and practical, and I saw some stuff. I was like, oh, great. I'm totally going to do some of this. So I thought it was great.
That's, I liked it too.
That's awesome.
I liked that it was organized by age and development. And really practical, because I've almost never seen that from churches giving resources to parents on their webpage. And the way that it let them know which things were happening in that church that could support the parents. I think that would be really valuable, especially in big churches like ours. I was floored the other day to find out from our member care guys that at our church, there's something like, they push everybody to get in a community group because they realize that it's a really big church and that's the only way you're really going to develop true community in a church that big is by getting in a community group. But they told us the other day that there's something like 2,000 people at our church who aren't in a small group of some kind, who are just like loose out there. And they were like, you know, and so they're not being shepherded on that more personal level. But especially for families like that, if they're bringing their kids to church, but they're not necessarily in community with other parents or older parents who could maybe mentor them, a page like this is really helpful because it gives them some concrete guidance on how to shepherd their kids, and also reinforces, hey, here's what's happening in the church that you could be taking advantage of, or ways that the church could be supporting you that you might not know about if you're not more plugged in than just coming to the service. And I thought that was cool.
In terms of the, you both mentioned the article being divided by ages, and Katie, since you have older children and younger children, you might be able to speak to this more, but as your kids age, are there any periods or milestones that spiritually were different for your kids than you expected, or surprising to you, or tougher to handle? Anything about that you would like to share?
It's less to do, I think, with age than it is to do with, maybe because we're also grappling with kind of special needs, because I kind of expected, especially Arden, to maybe decide that, you know, she wanted to say that she believed when she was around 7 or 8, partially because she seemed really close to it, but also because they did a very interesting study one time. I think it was specifically in the Southern Baptist Church, and they researched and they, you know, looked at all these like records of people's baptisms and stuff. And they like calculated that the age at which people who not counting people who got saved as adults, but among people who got saved as kids in the Southern Baptist Church, it was like 7 years, 8 months. Like they found like an actual trend, like they were able to like map it and be like, that's the age at which a lot of kids like got it, like understood the gospel on a basic level enough to want to say, yes, this is what I believe. And so when she seemed like at that age, that's kind of the way she was going, I was like, it's true.
That's wild. I professed my faith when I was 8. I didn't get baptized until I was 9, but I professed my faith publicly for the first time when I was 8. That's wild.
I'm telling you, me too. And I feel like David was younger, but the way that it went, like I didn't expect, is that I felt like she was like super, super close to it. But then she kind of like eased off. And we've had a lot of talk since then. She's 12. I mean, she's in sixth grade, but, David and I sometimes think, David even more strongly than I do, we sometimes wonder if our child, I think she probably actually maybe does believe. And we're both pretty convinced that she actually has the Holy Spirit and guiding her. I think maybe she does. Because of autism, I think she knows Jesus and doesn't realize that she does. Because the things that she says, the ways that she understands things, the concern that she has for sanctity and holiness, to me, doesn't make sense if she doesn't already have faith. But we're not going to try to, again, we're not going to push that on her. Like, she's going to have to come around to that on her own. And the other thing that surprised me a lot, but again, this is a special needs thing, not just a kid thing, is that she struggles a lot with something that is the Catholic word for it is scrupulosity, which I'm sure Victoria knows.
Oh my gosh. Girl, you know I am super scrupulous. Like, how long have we been friends? It's a whole thing. Every single time I go to confession, I have like an app that helps you examine your conscience. And my current practice is every time I examine my conscience, when I make the list of my sins, before I go into the confessional, I cross one off and don't confess it because I know I have been too scrupulous. Like, I have to be okay. Like, was that really a sin? No, it wasn't. Because I 1,000%.
Well, and
Victoria, I'm imagining like Coco Chanel being like, when you're leaving the house, look at yourself in the mirror and take off like one accessory or something.
Yep,
like
that. What I'm that, but mortal sin. Exactly.
Okay. Like, so I was a very guilty kid. So it's not just an autism thing, right? Some of it's, I think, personality, and she gets it from me, but she's always been that way. And I was so grateful for when she started coming on even stronger, I think, as her hormones have been changing, as she's headed toward puberty, it's changed her emotions some, but she's constantly worried that, is this sinful? Have I done something sinful? Oh no, I think I'm thinking something. It's like this, it's just like her brain's just always going around and around and around. And I was trying to find like ways to help support her, but all of the resources I was finding were all Catholic. I'm like, okay, whatever. Like, we're not Catholic, but I'm going to take it. Like, and you know, and that was where I learned that there's a word for it. Like, it's not just something individual to my child that only she struggles with because of autism. Like, that there are lots of people out there.
Did you read, is it Saints and the Scrupulous? It's like a really famous Catholic prayer pamphlet that I have read.
I think I saw reference to it, but I didn't read through the whole thing. I need to.
It's super helpful.
I think, well, and I think it would, and I need, it's good for us to read that stuff too, because since we're not Catholic and since she's not going to be headed into a confessional, we're her people. Like, we're her people that she tells things to, right? And her parents. We're the people, the safe people that she can be like, she can always check in with us and be like, I did this. Was this a problem? Or like, I thought this was this. And, but so often with her, she'll be like, Mom, I thought about this. And I'll be like, okay, that's just human. That's not a sinful. I mean, so many things that, you know, or often now she'll be like, Mom, you know, this thing happened, or I read this thing in a book and I really liked it. And it's like something romantical. And I'm like, that's 'cause puberty. Like, that's a very normal thing. Like,
bless her, you know, sweet little heart.
She's just, yeah. So, which, and she'll probably listen to this when she's a grown up and cringe. But like, so, you know, she,
well, Arden, try and love you if you do listen to this eventually.
Well, and she's so, it's just interesting because she's so logical, and in some ways can vary and, you know, analyze things logically in a very detached way. But then when it comes to things like sin and how that affects her personally, or, you know, it's very much, and I, you know, it's something that she struggles with. So that's the thing that maybe has surprised me so far in raising our kids up to, you know, I'm more prepared. I feel like I was more prepared to deal with the kinds of questions that Cadman asks, because he'll ask questions like, you know, or he'll say things like, Mom, it's really hard for me to believe in God because I can't see him. Like, I'm like, okay, I know where I am with that. Like, that's something that a lot of kids ask, you know. That piece of it, you know, trying to support her as she's constantly grappling with this feeling of sinfulness, even when it's not even, you know, particularly because, like, we believe in original sin. So technically, yes, she is always in a state of sin, as we all are. But trying to help convince her that she doesn't need to be constantly policing herself for every tiny deviation from what she thinks is the norm or is holiness when it's not even sinful, like, that's been kind of, that's been surprising. And it's been something that I've been trying to work on. And that's, I think that was when I found the book I'm going to recommend tonight, which is by a Catholic writer, about, specifically about autism and people of faith who are autistic, but we'll talk about that later.
I started reading that book on your recommendation, actually, and it's really lovely.
I know.
But if Obviously, you do not have to take me up on this, but if you ever think it would help her to speak to a scrupulous adult and have me talk about how I deal with it, I'm 100% on board for that anytime.
Absolutely. Well, cause, like we've been saying this whole time, you know, we should have people who aren't our kids' parents involved in their spiritual development, which, and I forgot, I wanted to ask you closer to the top of this episode, what kinds of things are you doing with Frankie and with your nieces and nephews? Like, what kinds of ways are you trying to support them, or ways that you see their churches supporting them that you like?
So the book that I'm going to recommend at the end of the episode is one of the first baptism presents I gave Frankie, my goddaughter, the smartest, most beautiful, bestest baby to ever be born.
love it.
And except for you guys as kids, of course. I'll talk about that. It's different. Like, the nieces and nephews are different than my experience with her. Obviously, as her godmother, like, my explicit role is her spiritual formation, too. So, like, I give her a lot of religiously focused gifts. I pray with her when we visit them. She prays for us at night during her prayer. It's the sweetest thing you've ever seen. So I do, you know, these are conversations that I have with her. The nieces and nephews, it's slightly different, both because they're older. I mean, I can talk to the 18-year-old and the 15-year-old very differently, but not all of those family members are themselves believers. So it is different in terms of that kind of negotiation.
Sure. Okay.
But, I mean, I have loved this conversation tonight so much because I feel like the two of you have given me a lot of really great tips in terms of how I can support this kind of development as someone who is a trustworthy adult who is not a parent. So I'm really glad that I got a chance to do this. I think we should probably move on to the second reading, which Katie mentioned earlier is an article by Jin Wilkin about kind of parenting through difficult and nebulous questions. Katie, can you tell us more about what this article is about?
Sure. I had read this a while back, and it came back to my mind when we were preparing for this episode. But Jen basically is, and it's from Christianity Today, 2022. She's talking about parenting in the light of the truths that are revealed in Ecclesiastes, and how there's a temptation to see parenting today, or, you know, I would add helping with any child's spiritual formation, like you're talking about, as being uniquely challenging, harder than ever before, you know, and there are very real dangers with things like technology that weren't necessarily present in the past, but she's talking about how Ecclesiastes always makes the point for us that there's nothing new. The sins that our kids are going to struggle with, they're not new sins. There's just new pathways, right? Or new methods. But lust is lust, pride is pride. You know, all of these things have always been around, and that's something that could make a person feel defeated, but it's also comforting because it lets you as a Christian parent know, hey, I'm not having to grapple with something that no one in the history has ever grappled with before. And that is comforting. And the way she kind of ended things that I really liked is she just talked about how we should be motivated not by fears of the times, not by fears of this unique moment, but by the fear of God, which is, you know, the fear of the Lord leads to knowledge. So I thought it was really, really good. What did you guys think?
I really appreciated it. My kids are still too young to ask some of those questions, but I think the thing that I like that I felt like I could really lean into was this idea that, you know, as parents, a lot of times we feel like we have to have an answer for everything, right? Our kids ask us, like, because we, because it feels like we do have an answer for everything. Like, well, when are we doing that? Like, you really direct every part of your kid's day. And I think letting some of that go is really, really difficult, because then when you think, well, what else are they going to question? If I, you know, if I can't give them the perfect answer about who Jesus is, or why did bad things happen to someone we know, that we will somehow have failed them. But I did appreciate that, like, you know, you're going to answer as best you can, and God will take care of it. In the same way that, you know, if God looks after the lilies of the field, he will also help with that hard question, right? Because when I was a kid, I had no idea how much stuff my parents were just flying by the seat of their pants. Because when you're a kid, your parents seem like they have the answer. This is what they told you. This is it.
You don't think your parents are human beings until you're a teenager at the very earliest, right? You just think of them as parents with a capital P, which is something altogether different, right?
Yeah, and they act like they know everything. And I think letting you know, when your kids have some of those questions, answer it to the best of you can. That's one of the things that's also really helpful about having a confession or a catechism that you can go back to. So when they say, what is it when a prayer is, I have a really good answer that I can just be like, well, let me look up real quick, but I know what the correct answer is, and I know where to find it, sweetheart, right? Like, I think there is some comfort in that. I don't have to go, like, somebody wrote and thought about and created a much better answer than I can come up with when you ask me that. So let's just go look at that and see. And you know, what is prayer? Prayer is talking, singing, thinking towards God. Like, that's what prayer is. And it can be out loud, it can be inside your head. And like, and it's nice that those things are there, because generally there's some of those big questions, like the catechism has a really good answer for it. Like, I've never seen an answer where I'm like, you know what? A 12-year-old probably couldn't really understand that. Now, maybe a small child, but it's written and designed for people to use in their everyday life, and it's very helpful for that.
And there are, you know, I'm sure in all traditions, I know that the Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church both have different catechisms written for younger children, middle grades age children, you know, confirmation age children.
That's cool.
Those sorts of things.
I appreciate that. I think that that's really good. And yeah, I like what you're saying, Sarah, about being able to not feeling like you have to have the answer all the time. And because the risk there too is that if the parent act like you always have every spiritual answer, then you run the risk of your child just believing in you instead of in God. Right. Like, you know, my mom had not a stern conversation with me, but my mom had a conversation with me when I was a kid, because I was a pretty scrupulous kid, like my kid is. And I would always want to, you know, confess every sinful thought to her all the time. And at one point, once I was old enough to understand, she was like, hey, this sin that you're sharing with me right now, does it affect me? Like, is this a wrong you did against me? And I was like, well, no. And she's like, okay, then that's between you and God. Like, you don't have to tell me that as your mother. Like, that's something that you can ask for forgiveness for. And that was like a revelation to me, because I kind of had just put her in the position of the one who was giving me expiation, right?
That's like, why you need a priest.
Well, clearly that was the drive I thought I had as a kid. But I that as a kid, that was really, I think that was the right tack for her to take with me, because I think I was running the risk of making her not like an idol, but of, you know, attempting to replace, you know, the confession to God with confession to her.
Right. That makes sense.
And we definitely try to push that with Arden too, of like, hey, you know, I'm happy for you to tell me things that you feel like are wrong, and I'm happy to talk to you about if that was sin or not. But also you need to also be asking God to forgive you. Right. You know, like, it's not just about, and she does. And we had to have a whole talk with her at one point about how she needed to try to get in the habit of praying silently, at least out in public, because she's, and we never stopped her from doing this. I think this is necessary for her, but she's the kind of person that she would, if she felt like, anytime she felt like she had a sinful thought, she would immediately be whispering frantic prayers under her breath, like wanting to like ask for forgiveness immediately, which is admirable. But if you're out, if you're in class, you can't do that. Like, you know, and so we tried to think of different ways to address it. Like at one point we had given her, like I had given her like a beaded bracelet and was like, hey, you know, maybe you can,
did
like,
she have some rosary beads, Katie?
She doesn't have rosary beads. Y'all, we're trying so hard to give her the physical objects, even though we're Protestant, we're doing our best. but like she had a bracelet and we were like, okay, instead of saying a prayer over and over, like maybe you can hold on and pray silently in your brain. And some of that's just developmental. As she's gotten older, especially in the last year, she's definitely, she still sometimes prays out loud, and we've never told her it was wrong to pray out loud at home. We're like 100% pray out loud as loud as you want, if you're not in a situation where it would be rude to do so, right? But at school, I think she's changed a lot. And I think that she's getting more and more used to praying in her own mind. She and I had a whole conversation recently about how do you stay awake to pray if you're praying in your bed at night? She was like, Mom, I feel terrible. I just fall asleep when I'm praying. And I said, one, same. That happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
Two, I can understand you feeling guilty about that because you want to finish out your prayer. But at the same time, I think it's low-key beautiful to fall asleep praying. Like, you're talking to God and then you're asleep. Like,
if prayer is something that, like, as a incredibly scrupulous person, who the kind of scrupulous who, like, if I feel like I'm not focusing enough on my, I do a certain number of Hail Marys and Our Fathers mm-hmm. in the morning before I get out of bed and at night before I go to sleep. And if I feel like I am not focusing on them properly, I will start the whole thing over. Do I need to do that? No, I don't. In fact, it's probably bad to do that, but like that is my impulse. So I get that 100%.
Well, and I try to walk the line of like telling her, you know what? I don't think God is angry with you if you fall asleep while you're praying, but if it bothers you that you fell asleep before you finished praying, here's some things you could do to help yourself stay awake. And we talked about like you can sit up in bed until you're done praying instead of lying down. Like, you know, I tried to help her come up with some strategies like to stay awake if it's bothering her.
I think that's a really good middle ground to strike. That's great.
Yeah. Because we, you know, I want her to experience faith in a way that feels comfortable to her. But sometimes I think with her, that's going to mean trying to get her to allow herself to be a little bit uncomfortable so that she's focused on the right things and so that she's not so caught up in her feelings of wanting to do it the exact right way that she's like missing the forest for the trees kind of thing.
Sometimes you have to cross a sin off the list before you go in the confessional. I get it. Like,
I'm so glad you told me that. Like, and because it's so nice, I mean, having that filed away too, so that, because I, you know, that's the kind of thing that I would share with her and be like, hey, you're not the only one who struggles. Like, you know, and she knows about me. I've told her that I, you know, that I was very, very similar to her at the same age. And so, you know, but it's nice to know.
Please, if you feel like that will be helpful to her, you have my full permission to share that.
Okay. I'll talk to her about it. And I try to like, I try to make sure that she knows too that, you know, we talk about other friends that we have, you know, and how they believe. And one of the things I liked, Victoria, actually, about the very first article you mentioned at the beginning, the PBS one, the one that assumed you were secular, I actually really enjoyed that. I was shocked by how, yeah, you're right, there was more of a defensive posture, but I was shocked the degree to which that article, which the writer, she was saying things like, maybe don't freak out if your kid, you know, hears about God at school. Like, I was surprised the degree to which she was seeing religion as a force happening in culture that doesn't have to be harmful to your kid. But I liked the kind of the talk in that about, you know, making religion just something you talk about around the house like anything else. And she meant it for secular parents so their kids can, she said something like religious literacy is a gift, which I thought was really interesting for a secular person to say. And she meant it so that your kid knows about religion so they can, you know, not be weirdly ignorant of it. But I think that's also a good idea, especially for our kids, because Arden puts so much intense weight on everything spiritual and freaks herself out about it. I think we try to have a, this is something that we absolutely believe is true, but it's also something we talk about all the time. We're not, you know, I try to make sure that every conversation we have with her that's spiritual doesn't feel deep, weighty, heavy, intense, right? Because she's already there. She's there on the inside. Right. She doesn't need that from us too.
And I think it's great that you're understanding where she's coming from and going from there. I think that it's obviously what you need to be doing with you know, any individual kid.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think probably it is time to talk about our final segment of this and every episode, our passing on segment, where we recommend something that you should read, watch, listen to, that we think is cool or important, that may or may not be related to the topic of this week's episode. So, Sarah, kick us off. What are you recommending?
So I'm recommending Timothy Carney's book that was published this year called Family Unfriendly. And it really takes the opinion that, you know, children are a net good for society. We should be a pronatal nation. And that he talks about that there are a lot of ways in which culture is set up to be very unfriendly to families, and especially large families. And he recommends some cultural changes and just and some best practices that can cause your family to be and cause life to be less stressful. So he talks about get out of the travel sports racket. Your children are going to be better off and more emotionally healthy if you let them wander outside and get dirty and then just come back than if you have them have incredibly prescribed, you know, piano lessons, then tennis lessons, then swimming lessons, then, you know, and that we have a generation of children that suffer from anxiety, depression, and all sorts of mental health issues that they didn't have before. And one of the things he postulates for this is that we know children are left alone less. Children are not encouraged to work out their differences amongst themselves without an adult being there to intervene. And that he really advocates for the kind of childhood that a lot of Gen Xers had, and, you know, some maybe a couple of us elder millennials. And so it 100% appeals to me, because I'm like, yeah, that's totally what my parents did, and I turned out awesome. But one of the things I liked about it is I see some friends and peers who are just petrified to let their children do things or let their children try things, because what if it's dangerous? What if it's bad for them? What if they get hurt? And he talks a lot about the appropriate understanding of risk, and that on average your child is going to be okay, and that we need to let children experience things more, and that they're more likely to have happier, healthier childhoods if we kind of give them a little more freedom to play and be without adult supervision.
Thanks. That sounds really interesting. Katie, what do you have for us?
So, as I've been saying all along, raising our kids and their spiritual formation is very informed by the fact that three of our kids are autistic. So the book that I'm recommending tonight is called God Loves the Autistic Mind, Prayer Guide for Those on the Spectrum and Those Who Love Us by Father Matthew P. Schneider. And he obviously is coming from the Catholic perspective because he is a priest. But I really appreciate this book because he puts particular emphasis on the fact that an autistic person of faith, that God made that person that way. And so God is expecting and wanting that person to respond to himself, God, in an autistic way, because that person is autistic. Basically, that there's no need to kind of force an autistic person into more neurotypical ways of doing faith in order for them to, they shouldn't have to do that to be fully integrated into the life of the church and to experience their faith with joy and intention. So I really appreciate it, because he is an autistic person writing the book. So he's not writing from the outside, you know, and I mean, that's not to say that somebody can't write a book about autism related stuff and not be. There's a lot of great books about parenting kids with autism written by parents who aren't autistic. But in this case, his whole exploration is, what is it like to be a person of faith and also be autistic? And he knows that from the inside. And so the book is set up as kind of 52 different meditations, which is useful because if you wanted to work through it slow, you could read one each week and finish the book in a year. But he walks through different types of prayer, which I appreciated. The way we talk about prayer in our, you know, kind of low church Baptist context is often very unformed. It's a conversation with God, which is, it's true, it is. But he talks about different ways of praying, different types of praying, different ideas for prayer to structure that prayer time. And I think that would be helpful to a lot of people on the spectrum. So I really can't recommend it highly enough. Again, I'm a Protestant. I loved this book. It's going to be super useful for me. So you don't have to be Catholic to read it. So, God Loves the Autistic Mind by Father Matthew Snyder.
I have not read the whole thing, but I have read several chapters, and I found it deeply lovely.
He's a very gentle person, which is a weird thing to say that you can feel that coming through the text. I don't often say that about a writer, but his perspective is so gentle and kind, and he is so thoughtful in the way that he talks about everything that it really is a pleasure to read, like you said, Victoria.
Thanks. My recommendation is a children's book called This is the Church by Katie Warner. And it is a Catholic children's book. And it's first and foremost just a beautiful piece of religious art. The book is entirely black and white, except for each page has a set of rainbow-colored stained glass windows that walks you through the salvation story, the life of Jesus, and there's also a few saints in there as well. And this is the house that Jack built style of progression. So this is the Holy Catholic Church built by Jesus Christ, established and it, you know, repeats every page. But as I said, gave it to my goddaughter either after her baptism or for her first Christmas. I can't remember which, but it's one of her favorite books, and it's one of my favorite books now, too. It's really beautiful. The pictures and the kind of religious content. So that's my recommendation. This is The Church by Katie Warner. And that is going to wrap up episode 197, Religious Instruction for Children. Thank you for listening to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a topic or a reading recommendation, or if you just want to say hi, you can do so at christianfeministpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page or at the network's Twitter handle, @CHRadioNetwork. And you can check out show notes from this and other episodes at the Christian Humanist blog at christianhumanist.org. The Christian Feminist Podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Kristen Filippic is our press liaison. For Katie and Sarah, I'm Victoria. Tune in about a month when we'll discuss the tradwife phenomenon. Until then, in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things, love.